Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have Vivian Liska, Professor of German Literature and Director of the Institute of Jewish Studies at the University of Antwerp in Belgium, as well as a distinguished visiting professor in the Faculty of the Humanities at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. She's here to talk about her new book, German Jewish Thought and Its Afterlife, A Tenuous Legacy, published in 2017 by Indiana University Press. Vivian, thanks very much for joining us on the show. First question, how did you come to write this book?
Well, I was always interested in not only German Jewish literature and thought, but also in its reception, in the way it was read by scholars, but mainly, and this is what led me directly to write this book, in the reception by other thinkers and philosophers. In this case, I've looked more closely into the philosophical reception of the German Jewish thinkers and authors that interested me most: Hannah Arendt, Walter Benjamin, Gershom Scholem, Franz Kafka, and Paul Celan. Now, my choice was corroborated by a distinction made by the scholar Stefan Moses, who distinguishes between normative and critical Jewish modernity. Normative Jewish critical Jewish modernity for him, there are those thinkers who try to adapt Judaism to the modern age, as opposed to those he calls critical thinkers, critical Jewish modernity, thinkers who use elements of the Jewish tradition to think modernity. What really interested me was to see to what extent these thinkers, who are, let's say, for some marginal to Jewish studies, and have a very complex relationship to Judaism, to what extent they can be linked to a genuinely Jewish tradition, what that would mean, and how this aspect of their work has fared with thinkers in the 20th century up until today. One of the real reasons that got me to write this book was the realization that recently, in the decades, let's say from the final decade of the 20th century up until today, this Jewish dimension has been either appropriated, deflected, negated for the sake of other beliefs, other ideologies. And I was particularly interested in that. So what I'm doing in my book, I'm reconstructing, on the one hand, the Jewish elements that are present in the way these thinkers and authors relate to modernity, and on the other hand, how this Jewish dimension has been reflected upon, thought about, discussed in thinkers of the recent times.
So the book is divided into four parts, reflecting four different elements of Jewish tradition. And in each section, you highlight the thought of one German Jewish thinker. So we'll start with the first section titled Tradition and Transmission. And this focuses on Hannah Arendt. Tell us about your argument here.
Well, first of all, the reason behind this structure. Yes, it is true that it is structured according to these thinkers, but what mattered to me even more was that it is structured according to elements of the Jewish tradition itself. So tradition and transmission is not exactly specific, but one sees with the other three how it does link up directly with the Jewish tradition. One section is called Law and Narration, of course, relating to the idea of Judaism as a religion of the law. another messianic language, so Jewish messianism, and a third, exile, remembrance, exemplarity. In each case, I am trying to link the way these thinkers have thought about modernity and an element that is genuinely deep within the Jewish tradition, yes, such as the law. So in Hebrew terms, it would be halacha and agadah, hitgalut, galut, zachor. So they're actually terms that are deep within the Jewish tradition. Now, it is only after I made this structure that I realized that there is one figure in each case is predominant. But in each case, in the subchapters, I am mainly discussing conversations, epistolary exchanges between that central figure and another figure. So in the case of Arendt, it starts with how she dealt with the romantic Jewish woman epistolary writer and salonnière Rachel Barnhagen. Then I'm discussing Arendt's reading of Gershom Scholem's Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism, and in a third part of that first section, I am discussing Giorgio Agamben's reception of Hannah Arendt's and of Hannah Arendt and the Jewish dimension in her work. Giorgio Agamben is an Italian contemporary philosopher, and he was really the one who made me realize how radical, but also how important and interesting the way these German Jewish thinkers are dealt with is for our understanding of our times in intellectual terms in relation to the German Jewish tradition, but maybe the Jewish tradition altogether. I was interested in Arendt to a large extent because she, although there's a big volume on Arendt's Jewish writings, just collecting her writings that do relate to Judaism, she has often been looked upon as someone very ambivalent about her relation to Judaism. And I'm trying to show how this matters in her book, Rachel Barnhagen, a book that she wrote between the early 30s until 1958 when it was published. And it is very important there to see how it exemplifies the tension between embracing Jewish particularism on the one hand and hailing enlightened universalism on the other. By the way, this is really my main argument in the book. I'm fascinated by the way in which these German Jewish thinkers have held this tension in their works alive, the tension between European modernity on the one hand and the Jewish tradition on the other, and how this tension plays out in their major writings. Very often, a tension that remains unresolved in any conceptual terms. So it is not that they come to a kind of result, but the way they deal with it is something that is of great actuality even for today. And my contention with their contemporary reception is that very often this tension is torn apart. So that they are regarded either as either in terms of their Jewishness, much more rarely in terms of their link to the Jewish tradition, but in terms of their Jewishness on the one hand, and or as European modern thinkers. But that is precisely what tears this tension apart. So I am, in terms of Hannah Arendt, I am starting to look at this in this early book on Rachel Varnhagen, then in her discussion of Gershom Scholem's Major Trends. And finally, I'm showing how this Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben divests Arendt's writings of that Jewish dimension and appropriates it for something else.
Okay, so your second section is on Kafka and the interaction between law and narrative. Tell us a bit about this.
In some ways, my Kafka section is the center of the book. My previous book was called When Kafka Says We. I've been writing on Kafka for decades. And I'm particularly interested in, the section is called Law and Narration. And I'm particularly interested in how Jewish law relates to Kafka's modernist literature and how these two aspects interact precisely in terms of this tension. And again, I am also here in each case discussing Kafka in relation to another thinker, to another author, sometimes to several others. So there are three sections in this, there are three texts in the second part. One of them is on Giorgio Agamben as reader of Kafka. And here it becomes even clearer than in the Arendt section what is happening to these German Jewish thinkers and authors today. And I show how Kafka's relation to Jewish law, very ambivalent in many ways, but nevertheless very strongly linked to the Jewish tradition, is read by Giorgio Agamben in terms of a new Pauline thinking. So where the Apostle Paul is taking center stage and becomes a kind of model to suspend the law, which is thought at the same time in terms of the Apostle Paul having suspended the law after the resurrection of Christ, and him being a kind of model for an anarchist thinking of today, so that Jewish law and state law are both considered by Giorgio Agamben, but also by other thinkers of today, as a kind of oppressive system. And I show how for Kafka, but also for readers of Kafka like Walter Benjamin, this is thought in very different terms. One article in the second section on Kafka deals with Kafka's Job. And here I'm looking at how philosophers have associated the biblical figure of Job with Kafka in very unexpected ways very often. And although Kafka never actually mentions this biblical figure himself, and I try to derive from other writings in Kafka how he would have read Job, and that turns out to be very differently from the ways in which these philosophers have read Kafka in terms of this eternal sufferer and altogether of the book of Job.
So your next section is an examination of Walter Benjamin and the conception of messianic language. Tell us a bit about this.
For Walter Benjamin, messianism is probably the closest link to the Jewish tradition, and Walter Benjamin famously thinks together this messianic aspect of Judaism with his political aspirations and hope for a kind of radical revolution. And he has very rarely actually imagined what this messianic state would be. And the closest we come in his writings is the way in which he describes language. So in this section, I am doing a very close reading of the way he describes messianic language and the way Giorgio Agamben does. And I show how, while for Benjamin this is closely linked to certain Kabbalistic ideas on the one hand, but on the other hand, also linked to a kind of concern with everyday life, a concern that I see manifest in the Talmud, as opposed to readings by Giorgio Agamben and others, who again divest these Jewish, divest Benjamin's writings about messianic language of this Jewish dimension. In this section, there is also a discussion of, so again, there are, these are always discussions of conversations, of dialogues. One of the articles in this section discusses the French thinker Maurice Blanchot and the way he dealt with Walter Benjamin's idea of a pure language, so a language that was a paradisiac language, the language that Adam, with which Adam named the animals, and where there was a perfect coincidence between, so a perfect correlation between the word and reality, which got lost and which eventually, which got lost with the expulsion from paradise and will eventually return in messianic times. Benjamin's notion of pure language is read and again appropriated for a very different kind of thinking, in this case a very strikingly different one, whereas for Benjamin, messianic language is can be grasped in translation. It's a rather complex way in which Benjamin imagines that translation plays a role here. But what I show is that how Maurice Blanchot, reading Walter Benjamin's famous text, The Task of the Translator, how he brings this pure language, which is deeply ensconced in the Jewish tradition in Benjamin, in Maurice Blanchot turns into what he calls the union of the German and the Greek, so bringing it totally into another cultural context. A third article in that third section deals with Scholem and Benjamin in relation to the demonic, and here again I'm showing how a certain melancholic aspect of the writings of both Benjamin and Gershom Scholem is discussed critically by extremely by thinkers on opposite sides, and I'm talking about Moshe Idel on the one hand and Giorgio Agamben on the other, who both make a similar accusation, although they are on opposite camps. And I show how this melancholy actually results from the tension between European modernity and the Jewish tradition that I'm showing is so predominant in their work.
So your last section covers Paul Celan and the interrelated notions of exile, remembrance, and exemplarity. Tell us a bit about this.
I've been interested in the usage of the notion of the Jew as eternal wanderer, as ultimate exile, as ultimate figure in movement, in motion, for a long time, because I realized that it is that there is an immense discrepancy between exile as an experience, which is full of suffering, which is an extremely difficult thing to live, but how Jews are depicted as wonderfully exilic when it comes to an intellectual or philosophical context. I'm talking now, of course, about the period after 1945, because that is when many thinkers, like George Steiner, for example, hail the Jew for not being linked to a territory, for being free-floating, for being cosmopolitan. And there is a way in which these thinkers, and there are many others that I'm discussing in this chapter, one can see the attraction of trying to reverse the negative idea of the rootless Jew. But I also show that there are problems with this kind of celebration of exile. And my question becomes, how can one indeed bring in or bring together the metaphoric and the experiential or existential state of exile without, so at the same time doing justice to the suffering it involves and the suffering, the Jewish suffering from exile through the ages, at the same time as preventing to turn this into an affirmation of a kind of blood and soil ideology of being rooted in a place. And I'm finding in thinkers like Jacques Derrida, but also like Emmanuel Levinas, and in the poetry of Paul Celan, ways in which this can be at least thought, and that can give a direction as to how one can keep that tension alive. That section ends on a somewhat different article. It deals with Jeffrey Hartman's discussion of Midrash and of Holocaust testimony, where I show again how there is an attraction at the same time to a very modern thinking, at the same time as rooting it in the Jewish tradition.
So, well, thanks very much for talking to us today about your book, Vivian. As we've heard, it's a very interesting and thought-provoking book. Before we let you go, would you be able to tell us a little bit about what you're working on next?
Well, I'm currently trying to, I've had a few really inspiring events around my book with important discussions that came up, discussions and challenging questions. And maybe the one that I found most challenging was that someone asked me, well, your criticism of how not to carry on this legacy is very convincing, and your microanalyses are very powerful, but maybe the alternative of how to do this right is not made sufficiently explicit. And I am trying now to go beyond the critique that is formulated in my book, and try to think maybe less closely related to just the tensions that I can show, to how this can be implemented for the future of this tradition, this particular German Jewish tradition, but maybe for the Jewish tradition as a whole.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds like a very challenging but worthwhile project, and we certainly hope to have you back on New Books in Jewish Studies down the track to discuss that if it eventuates into a book. So thanks very much again for being on the program, Vivian. So with us today we had Vivian Liska, Professor of German Literature and Director of the Institute of Jewish Studies at the University of Antwerp in Belgium, as well as a distinguished visiting professor in the Faculty of the Humanities at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And she talked to us about her new book, German Jewish Thought and Its Afterlife, A Tenuous Legacy, published in 2017 by Indiana University Press. Thanks very much.